I had dinner last night with Shaf Khashoggi, a friend and colleague who's a complete superstar and who I highly respect. And it's his belief that we may someday be able to alter kidneys so that patients aren't going to need anti-rejection drugs. I mean, when you consider where we were 50 years ago, which is, I guess, when I was an intern, 1975, and where we are now, it's a totally different world.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital. I'm your host, Candace. Each episode, we share the powerful stories of transplant recipients and living donors, along with insights and education from leading medical professionals. Today, we're joined by a true pioneer in kidney care and transplantation, Dr. Ed Cole. Dr. Cole is a nephrologist at the University Health Network with a remarkable career spanning more than five decades. Since beginning his work in the 1970s, he's witnessed and helped lead extraordinary advancements in transplant medicine, from early dialysis innovation to today's precision-based and patient-centered approaches to care. In this episode, Dr. Cole reflects on how far the field has come, the innovations that have shaped kidney transplantation over the years, and what continues to drive progress and compassion in patient care. Please enjoy. All right. Welcome back to the Living Transplant Podcast. It's my absolute pleasure to have Dr. Edward Cole here with me in studio. Welcome.
Pleasure.
Dr. Cole, you've been part of the transplant community for many years. I'm wondering if you can talk to me a little bit about when you first started in nephrology and what really drew you to that field and transplant specifically.
So I looked after my first transplant patient as an intern. I think it was 1975.
Amazing.
At that time, it was at the Toronto Western Hospital with Dr. Carl Cardella and some other people that are no longer with us. Carl's still a colleague. And in those days, the one-year success rate of a kidney transplant was 50-50.
Wow.
And the only transplants, the only solid organ transplant that was being done was kidney.
Mm-hmm.
And prednisone and imuran azathioprine were the only anti-rejection drugs we had. The risk of rejection was probably around 50%, although I can't remember exactly.
Wow.
And I finished my training in 1981. And I was working in a transplant clinic at St. Michael's for several years, and I moved to St. Michael's Hospital in 1985. Was there until 92, and I've been at Toronto General UHN since 92. So we go from 1 year's success of a deceased donor transplant of 50% to our current 1 year success rate of 90%. For living donors now, it's probably 95 or a bit higher. The rejection rate has gone way down to about 12%. And I think there are a number of things that have been responsible for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't happened all at once. It's been gradual change.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing was cyclosporin. Mm-hmm. That publication actually came from Canada. And I think it was around 1982, if I'm not mistaken, that the randomized trial was published showing an improvement in kidney transplant survival. Then it started being used. We then got mycophenolate mofetil, Cellceptor, Myfortic, as we call it. Mm-hmm. That was in the late 90s at half the rejection rate. Then we got tacrolimus, probably around the late 90s. And our current strategy, we still use prednisone. Not all patients do, but we bring the dose way down early, much earlier than we used to. So the side effects of that are much less.
Mm-hmm.
But we're using prednisone, tacrolimus, Myfortic, Cellceptor, the same thing. And we have our current results. I guess the other major change, and this has been a gradual one, but most of our kidneys are not well matched. That means the proteins on the cell surface that are responsible for matching are called HLA antigens. Now, if you're an identical twin, you'll probably be identical. If you're a sibling, you'll probably have a 1 in 4 chance of being an identical match. If it's a parent child, it's a probably 50% match. So the real biggest benefit is in the identical match. But there's some benefit of other matching. What's really happened is that for most patients, the critical issue is not match, but it's what we call donor-specific antibody. And that refers to whether the recipient has antibodies against donor HLA antigens, proteins on the cell surface of the kidney. And we've become much, much better at detecting those antibodies and being sure that in our case, we really don't transplant kidneys anymore where there are antibodies in the recipient against the donor. The next big advance was kidney paired donation. And I'm turning around because I have to look at the front page of the Globe and Mail. We did the first one. I think it was with Vancouver and Edmonton in 2009, and it made the front page of the Globe and Mail. That's what's referred to as a swapping program, where we have incompatible living donor and recipient, or a bunch of them, and we wind up swapping kidneys such that the recipient gets a kidney from another donor, and their donor gives to another recipient, and suffice it to say, we developed a Canadian registry and we have a computer program and we've done probably well over 1,000 of these across Canada, but it's been a huge success story. The problem is if you've got a lot of antibodies, it's very difficult to find you a donor kidney that you don't have antibodies to. And we developed across Canada this highly sensitized registry, and it's the same idea as the swapping program, where patients who have antibodies against 95 or higher percent of others, automatically providing they're willing to go into this national registry. And every transplant program across the country has a record of these people and their specific situation with antibodies, et cetera. So if a kidney comes up in Vancouver for a patient in Halifax who's in that registry, then Vancouver generally ships that kidney to Halifax and they transplant. And so we've done over 1,000 of those across the country. So, and then the other thing is that this varies by province, but I think that the organ retrieval organization, OPO is another term for it, but in Ontario, it's the Trillium Gift of Life program. I think that over the last, I don't know, maybe 10 years, maybe 15, maybe longer, they really improved the number of donors across the province. And that's made a huge difference in terms of the number of people we transplant. But people are still waiting way too long. So now I think that's probably enough for your first question.
That's fantastic. I think often our listeners are, you know, interested in hearing what's changed in the past, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. I know one friend who's had his kidney for 52 years. That's the longest one I've known. And I'm at 16.
That's probably, I wouldn't be surprised if that's about the longest. I've got a couple people that are more than 40 and certainly a number more than 30. But I don't think I got anybody that's more than 50.
Mm-hmm. And I'm at 16 now, so I'm pretty happy trucking along. And you know, it's interesting hearing you talk about the highly sensitized, because I've had my kidney transplant for 16 years. I've also had several blood transfusions in my life, and I have a 4-year-old daughter. So, you know, thinking about down the line, you know, what that looks like when I need a second kidney, you know, hearing about all of these programs that exist, it really, I guess, gives hope for people who will likely, you know, have these issues of matching with somebody that they know.
Yeah, I guess that it's worth pointing out, first of all, people are different. One blood transfusion, one pregnancy doesn't usually cause high antibody levels. And having a previous kidney, if you have not lost it from rejection, may not result in high antibody levels. So I don't think people should think that that's an absolute necessity. But if you've had multiple pregnancies and multiple blood transfusions and a previous kidney that's been lost from rejection, each of those things adds to the risk of having a lot of antibodies.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a little bit about that word rejection? Because I think, you know, when I was first transplanted, it was this like terrifying word that I'm like, if it ever happens, that's the end. And then, you know, as I've been learning more, it seems more like we're all in some kind of rejection. It's just kind of about managing that and making sure that our kidney, you know, continues to function. Can you kind of explain that rejection world?
Well, I wouldn't say that all of my patients are in rejection at all. Maybe my colleagues are, just joking. No, there are different kinds of rejection. So there's acute rejection, and that can occur within the first 3 to 6 months, say ballpark 12% of the time. And that often, not always, but often responds well to treatment. Okay. Those people may have a higher risk of rejection later on, but that does not automatically cause you to lose the kidney. In fact, most of the time you don't, although sometimes you do. We can see acute rejection later on. It's rather uncommon unless people are not taking their drugs as recommended. And it's not easy to take a bunch of pills every day, but you know, some people have a big problem with it. Some people have done well for years and they think that we're not truthful with them and that they can get away with stopping their drugs. Why we would tell them that is beyond me, but I've certainly had patients who've done great 7, 8, 9 years, then stopped their drugs and had a bad rejection and lost their kidney.
Oh, no.
So taking your drugs as directed, going to clinics as directed, doing your blood work as directed are critical issues. Now, we do see what we call chronic rejection,
okay,
which can occur later on, maybe after 3 to 6 months, after some years. It's more of a grumbling change. It's diagnosed the same way as acute rejection by a biopsy. And we're not as good at treating it as we are at acute rejection, although sometimes we're able to treat it, but a significant percentage of the time we aren't able to treat it all that well. And some people will go on over a period of months or years to lose their kidneys from that.
Okay. And so, you know, we're looking at numbers, and I know stats doesn't always help us, but you know, if somebody is to get a living donor kidney, on average, how long are we looking that that kidney might survive versus a deceased donor kidney?
Yeah, well, it's a little complicated because I think we're doing better now than we were 10 or 15 years ago. The kidneys that we're talking about now from 15 years ago may have been in a different era than the kidneys now. But what we would say is that the average for a living donor, but it's based on older data, is 15 to 20 years. But I'm a glass is half full guy, so I say half of them last longer than 15 years. The average for deceased donor is 10 to 15 years, but again, half of them last longer than 15 years. And I think that you know, if you're doing well, then hopefully you'll continue to do well.
Yeah, amazing. Can you talk to me too a little bit about the collaboration that goes into like one patient's care? I know it's a huge team that, you know, helps us stay healthy and, you know, kind of how to plan for that long term of how a patient would be taken care of.
So I guess we got to start with pre-transplant, which involves the dialysis unit or nephrologist for people that aren't on dialysis yet, the dialyzing nephrologist, the nurses there, our pre-transplant coordinators, physicians, our HLA lab that does the compatibility testing. And when people, and not for living donors, but when people get on the list, the Trillium Gift of Life program manages that list. And there's a whole bunch of people and a big computer system that are involved with that and handling the deceased donors. We have separate living donor coordinators and deceased donor coordinators. So that whole team. We've also got social workers, surgeons, anesthesia, the latter two involved in the surgery and technical complications with respect to surgeons. And then from a post-transplant point of view, the nephrologists and their coordinators, nurse coordinators, are the ones that are involved in a major way of managing the patients post-transplant. Sometimes there are surgical complications where we need the surgeons involved. And then over the long term, it's mostly the transplant physicians and coordinators that work as a team. And in our program, at least kidney, we tend to have each patient is assigned a specific transplant physician and coordinator. They work as a team and they manage the patient over the long term. The exception would be is if they're away on vacation or the patient gets sick and has to be admitted to the hospital, then somebody else may be involved. But we review all the hospital inpatients every week so that there's input from the people that know the patients best.
Massive team to keep one patient healthy and strong throughout their journey. It's pretty amazing. Now, I've noticed just, you know, personally and getting more involved in the community as well, I think that the patient voice has gotten much stronger in recent years. And, you know, seeing patients in research and planning, I'm wondering as a nephrologist if that has changed your practice or if, you know, you've seen any difference in research with that added insight from patients.
Yeah, I think there's no question that it's changed. I think there's no question that it's improved clinical care and research. I can tell you categorically that I sometimes have had patients ask me a question or raise an issue that I hadn't thought about. And the fact that they're reminding me that it's something to address has improved their care. It's important that patients are their own advocates, and it's important that they feel free to raise any issues, as should their family. And I think that the hospital is focused on that as an important issue. I think that in research, most of the major research organizations are interested in the patient's point of view about what studies are important, about what outcomes are important. I think patient-related outcomes are forming a part of more and more studies, not only lab tests, but how's the patient feeling, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's improved the enterprise in all kinds of ways. I feel compelled to say that I wish we could do better. I do not believe that our current healthcare system allows optimal patient access. It takes too long to get some tests done. It takes too long to get some operations done. You know, I continually feel badly about it. And mention it whenever I get the opportunity. Not that that helps, but you know, our system, unfortunately, it's not a bad system. I would not choose to work in any other system, but I think there are ways in which we need to improve it. We need to improve its efficiency. We need to improve how we use our inpatient resources and try and do more as an outpatient. That's not exactly what you asked, but I threw it in anyway.
I mean, it kind of brings me to another thought about, you know, those challenges in care for patients. When we think about equity, we think about access, addressing those gaps. And you mentioned a little bit there about, you know, how long it can take for patients to get through the system, and thinking about patients who have, you know, more barriers than others. Do you see that often in your patient care? And, you know, how do you see, I guess, either our system or maybe UHN specifically addressing those gaps, and what needs to be done there?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think UHN is a terrific hospital. And some years ago, I played a role in one of the senior leaders, but that was some years ago now, but I did get to see the system from closer to the top as well as the bottom, which is where I currently reside. Anyway, I do think it's a terrific institution. I think it's as good or better than other institutions, at least in this country. You know, if I compare it to the U.S., you know, in the U.S., you got a percentage of patients that don't have access to care, which is a complete disaster. But for those who do, their waiting times for test results, for procedures, are shorter than ours. So if you have a tumor here removed, you're going to wait a week or two, sometimes more, to get the results back. You wouldn't wait nearly that long in the U.S. If you need an MRI here, a lot of the time you can wait months for that. You'd probably be waiting days if you were in the U.S. So I'm not blaming anyone. I mean, the government has all kinds of requests for resources, so, and it's easy to point the finger. I think it's a difficult problem. We have more and more technology. Patients are doing better and better and living longer. I think UHN has a mismatch between the number of patients that are requesting our services and the amount of services that we can pay for, as it were. And so that leads to issues. But what I would say to people is, it's not good to be totally passive about this. If you have a problem and you call your coordinator or your doctor, and if you don't hear back for several days, you should bug them again, either through the patient portal or by calling. I guess you can't call that easily anymore. But, you know, none of us is perfect. I'm certainly not. And sometimes things get lost. It's not necessarily anybody's fault, but we don't want the patient to suffer because of it. I mean, you can't keep calling three times a day on every day because you'll drive us all crazy. But I wouldn't wait a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks for someone to respond to your concern about a problem. And, you know, I do think that's an important thing that patients need to keep in mind.
Yes. Advocating for ourselves is definitely important.
Yeah. Either for yourself or your family's advocating for you, whatever. I think patient advocates are important.
Absolutely. Now, thinking about, you know, advocating, I know that you have mentored quite a few clinicians in your time. I'm wondering, you know, what are some of your hopes for that next generation of nephrologists or transplant specialists, or, you know, even any care partners in this kidney team?
I've mentored a lot of outstanding people, and I think the vast majority of people in our field, both in the community and at the teaching hospitals, are outstanding doctors. I'm not somebody who believes that you can't get good care at the in the community, because I believe you can, but there are some specialized areas that they don't offer or don't have the expertise in. I think that the people that are currently coming into our field are much smarter than I am. I'd never get accepted now. The competition's way too great. So thank God I got accepted when I did. You know, I think if medicine is what you want to do, you should keep trying hard to do it. I went to medical school at Memorial in Newfoundland, which was a great medical school, because I was a bit wild when I was young and my grades weren't that great until later on. But I've never regretted it. It was a great medical school. And I would urge people, if this is, I don't think there's a better career in the world, personally, because it got so many opportunities. There's no substitute for working hard. No matter how smart you are, if you want to be successful in this field, you got to work hard. And on the one hand, in the end, nobody's going to care about you once you've retired or once you've left, unfortunately, in your workplace. And what you've got left in your is your family. So you've got to treat that with care and with the attention it deserves. But if you want to be highly successful, you're not going to be highly successful working 9 to 5 in this business. Mm-hmm. And I think there is, this is politically incorrect, but I'll accept that. This focus on work-life balance, in my opinion, has shifted too far one way. And as I say, you got to keep your family and friends close to you, but at the same time, you've got to organize your life so that you devote the time and energy to your career that it needs to do the best for your patients and the best for yourself. I think all of those comments need to be considered together.
Mm-hmm. That's good advice. Yeah. Yeah. Hearing from somebody who's been mentoring people, and you've seen the people who go far in this work. It is often those people who really, you know, lace up their shoes, you know, nose to the grindstone, you know, get that work done. And the teams that I've had in my personal kidney life are definitely the ones that stand out, are the ones that I know are going that extra mile to, you know, really make sure that we're taken care of. And I'm sure sometimes, like you said, their family life or their friend life might have to take a back seat once in a while for some of the things that they do, but hopefully they know, you know, how appreciative the patients are for them doing that for us, for sure. So this is a kind of an extension of what I've just asked, but on a more medical scientific level, what do you think, you know, we talked a little bit about recently in one of our kidney updates, Dr. Joe Kim shared some of the exciting innovations that are coming to transplant that people are talking about. When you think about the future of transplant, you know, whether it's 15 years from now or 30 years from now, what are you most excited about?
You know, the issues, I guess, that I would think about are trying to get more kidneys to more people, reduce the waiting time. Xenotransplantation has made some advances. It's not there yet. It may come. Dealing with people that have a lot of antibodies and trying to reduce the need for anti-rejection therapy and its side effects are two other important issues. Now, I had dinner last night with Shaf Khashavji, a friend and colleague who's a complete superstar and who I highly respect. And it's his belief that we may someday be able to alter kidneys so that patients aren't going to need anti-rejection drugs. So I think that, you know, xenotransplantation, we can also alter some genes. It has the potential to give us a better supply of organs. And if we can alter the genes in kidneys to offer them to the people with lots of antibodies without worrying about incompatibilities and reduce the need, or ideally eliminate the need, for anti-rejection therapy. I would see those are the things coming that might happen in the next 10 to 15 years. Now, you know, the other thing is that Shav Khashavji has developed this world-leading technology to take lungs that were not usable for transplantation, treat them between in the donor or after they come out of the donor, make them usable. And he's doubled the number of lung transplants we do. We're probably the biggest lung transplant program in the world. So maybe that technology might eventually be applied to other organs. People are working on it now. And so that's another area of focus that I would hope improves. I mean, when you consider where we were 50 years ago, which is, I guess, when I was an intern, 1975, and where we are now, it's a totally different world.
It is. Yeah. My dad's mom, she had a transplant it would have been in the early 80s. And she also used to do dialysis at home, and she would heat her dialysis bags up in her kitchen sink. And, you know, even thinking about that, like when we think about cleanliness and, you know, how when I did dialysis, we would mask up, we would use hand sanitizer, you know, all of these precautions, and, you know, thinking about what has changed and how the longevity of transplants now and how good our medication is as well. Hearing about not having to take medication, that's definitely, you know, music to, I think, any recipient's ears. I think that would be a really interesting thing to see for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other important point to make, although it's not your primary focus, is I think that dialysis is much better than it was in the 80s.
Yes.
And the outcomes of patients on dialysis are much better than they used to be. And home dialysis is more prevalent than it was in those days. And so, you know, I think for patients for whom it's suitable, transplant offers superior outcomes in terms of quality of life and in many patients' survival. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important to note that there have been significant advances in dialysis too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even the difference, I think, between my grandmother and myself, you know, doing home dialysis for me opened up so much for me to do school and to work and all of those things. You get a much more normal life, I think, compared to what it used to be. But lastly, I want to ask you, on a personal note, what has been one of the most meaningful pieces about being part of this kidney community and seeing the impact of transplant on a first-hand basis?
I think in terms of the kidney transplant community, I think that it's working with the colleagues and the trainees that I've worked with here and across Canada, developing those registries that I mentioned earlier. Without a doubt, those have been the most meaningful. And the number of smart people that I've worked with at all levels that have made me, by asking me questions or criticizing, providing useful feedback, maybe that's a better term,
right,
have made me better than I would have been otherwise. So that's probably what I'd say.
Incredible. And then one last thing, if you were to be able to talk to the patient base, the kidney patient base as a whole, maybe thinking about those waitlist patients, is there something that you would want to tell them?
You know, I guess that that they need to look after themselves, that doctors can only do so much, that patients have to also not only be advocates, but participate in their own care. I must say, again, this may be politically incorrect, but a lot of patients get their drugs sort of in batches from the pharmacy, and they kind of just take their pills out of Monday or Tuesday's pill box, and they don't know what they're taking. I don't think that's great. I think that's a step backwards. Not that it's easy to remember all your pills, but I think it's a disincentive for people to learn their pills. So You know, I wish you didn't have to wait as long as many of you do. I think you should consider the options that your transplant doctor gives you in terms of different kinds of donors. I think thinking about living donors and getting advice from you and your colleagues in the Center for Living Donation about how to approach family and friends is a really important piece. You know, we would love to do more living donors than we do. And those would probably be the main points that I'd
make. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today to talk about all of this. We're really grateful to have your insight and all of your expertise in this. It's wonderful.
Thank you for having me. Much appreciated.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.